And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Hi, this is Clint Broussard from Blues and Hi-Fi, and you are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Hello, everybody. This is Queer Voices, a podcast and radio show on KPFT 90.1 FM that's been on air for several decades as one of the oldest LGBTQ plus radio shows in the United States. From policy to pop culture, today's episode spans it all, including a timely interview with 2025 Pride Houston Ally Grand Marshal, Texas Representative John Rosenthal, on Texas's mid-decade redistricting and what these maps could mean for voters, as well as attacks on the LGBTQ plus community at the state legislature, and more. We close our show with a chat with Tice Green from the upcoming American Psycho musical, for a behind-the-scenes look at the production's sound, aesthetic, and the thrill of embodying a cult classic on stage. It's a full slate, so we're skipping the snippets. Let's get right into it with our newest contributor, Joel Tatum, and his conversation with Texas Representative John Rosenthal. Queer Voices starts now.
I'm Joel Tatum, and you're listening to Queer Voices. Today, we're focusing on a high-stakes fight unfolding in Austin as Democratic lawmakers were refusing to return to the statehouse in a bold act of resistance, walking out to deny the Texas House a quorum and halt a controversial mid-decade redistricting plan that would dramatically favor the Republicans. Let's chat about it today with Democratic Representative John Rosenthal of District 135. Hi, John. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad we can do this.
We've got a lot of action going on, I see.
We do indeed.
First of all, let's talk about the 2 weeks out of town first, and what that experience was like for you, and give us as much detail as you would like.
Okay, so it's definitely been a wild ride. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole thing, while there was a lot of planning that was in place as soon as we started the special session, pulling the trigger on actually having all of the Democrats break quorum happened very fast. Mm-hmm. As soon as that racist redistricting power grab came out of committee was when we decided as a group to leave town, and we jumped on a plane and flew to Chicago. And let me tell you, these people have pulled out all the stops, you know, to intimidate us, to coerce us, to threaten us. They had DPS officers parked outside of our families' homes, even though we weren't there. Some agitators were threatening individuals. We had one member who had tires slashed. It was really difficult. And that's before you get into the attorney general coming after us, filing lawsuits in four different states or something like that, and trying to charge Beto O'Rourke with a felony just for fundraising for us. You know, he hadn't even given us money when they were trying to do that. And of course, that's a free speech thing. It's just ridiculous. But all these tactics, charging us, fining us $500 a day for every calendar day. For those who don't know, we make $600 a month as state reps. So when you charge us $500 a day, that comes out of your pocket. And it was actually specified in the rule that they made up after the last quorum break that we could not pay out of campaign funds. So this is supposed to come out of our or out of our office accounts. So they're really trying to make it painful on us personally. But you know what? We all signed up and we persevered, and we killed that bill for the entire first called session. We brought national attention to the issue, and now it's all over the news, and California has started their special session for a trigger redistricting. So they've published a map that the state would vote on the ability to temporarily adopt and set aside their nonpartisan redistricting commission just to offset the seats that could be lost in Texas. Now, that does not help our people, you know, and you're in Houston with me, right? So they're going to, you know, really change the boundaries of Congressional 18, which is a historic district that Barbara Jordan served in, Sheila Jackson Lee, Craig Washington, you know, Sylvester Turner was in that seat, Mickey Leland, some real icons of Texas history. They are Black history in Texas. And then Congressional 9 will no longer be winnable for Al Green. So they're trying to redistrict him out of his seat. Mm-hmm. And it's a real mess.
Yes, it actually, well, you guys have been, first of all, you've been keeping Ken Paxton bouncing all over the place, which is, I'm trying to be as unbiased as possible, but it is hilarious.
So from an unbiased view, he's easily one of the most corrupt politicians in the history of this state.
Of course.
He was impeached by the Texas House of Representatives, and half of the Republicans voted to impeach him. It was so obvious and so egregious. And the lieutenant governor literally, you know, they talk about taking bribes and that stuff. Lieutenant governor took $3 million from Paxton allies in campaign contribution. And that's not considered a bribe. And then, lo and behold, the lieutenant governor then used the Senate to acquit Ken Paxton of his charges of misuse of office, bribery, corruption, you know, all kinds of misdeeds.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into when you make it back to town. We have a representative. I'm hoping I got her last name right. Representative Collier.
Yeah, Nicole Collier is one of my sheroes. Yeah. Nicole Collier is one of the best of us, the House Democratic mm-hmm. Caucus. So she's one of our more esteemed and talented members out of the Dallas area. And she refused to sign the permission slip where we agreed if we were leaving the chamber to have a police escort. Mm-hmm. So she refused to do that. And as a result, they have kept her locked in the Capitol, in the House chamber. She slept there last night mm-hmm. in an act of open defiance and righteousness.
If I recall, and I just read this today, I think she has thrown in a lawsuit as well.
I'm sure that's true. She's a very talented attorney. And like I said, the best and the brightest of us with quiet confidence and experience. And so here's some little inside baseball stuff. When we choose our seating assignment in the House chamber, we get to do that by seniority. And I moved my seat this time so I could sit next to Nicole Collier. So Rafael Anchia, who's another great, talented lawyer and one of our senior members out of Dallas, is my desk mate. And then right on the other side is Nicole Collier. And she, like, I think I'm a good researcher. I'm an oil field engineer, and I'm a total wonky nerd kind of person. I do a lot of research. I do not come close to the preparation that Nicole Collier does. She is amazing, like in real life, totally amazing, and at large, in charge with this quiet kind. You never see her yelling or getting visibly, you know, agitated. She is just cool and calm and slices people apart with a scalpel. She is truly amazing.
Mm-hmm. And our... As a Democratic voter, I need to ask this question. Should we be extremely worried? Should we be with all this redistricting madness, I will call it, should we be worried?
Yes, absolutely. And I think people across the country are worried because what's happening, I mean, The issue in Texas obviously is local, and they're going to dismantle historic districts and combine districts and try and force some of our great congressional representatives out. But really, if the if the way to combat this is fighting fire with fire, which is what Democrats are doing, finally. And while I'm happy to see Democrats showing a spine, if we get into a national redistricting war where states are just going to redraw their maps every time they have an election, if one side or the other, whoever's in charge, thinks they're going to lose, that really deprives people of their ability to pick their representatives. So you have partisans and party bosses in Washington and Virginia drawing these maps, and they choose the voters to keep certain people in office. It's supposed to be the voters selecting our representatives, right? It's supposed to be the other way around. And so the real push here needs to be for a federal law to outlaw partisan gerrymandering across the board. Let there be fair maps. Let people have contests of ideas, and let communities of common interest be collected together to elect the leaders to represent them in government.
And with the midterms coming up, how do you think, in your opinion, how do you think Democrats will fare in the midterms? Looking at
even with all the redistricting and the prognosticating and everything else, I don't think they're quite taking into account the backlash that we may see from this, from the horrible administration. Like, I hate to even use the convicted felon in the White House. I hate to even use his name. But if their policies are so bad that they have to rig the maps to try to keep control of Congress, you know that they are running scared. They're desperate to keep control, because they know that Democrats are likely to take control of the House and maybe the Senate, too. And I'm going to add this. The last time that dude was president, when that administration came in and they were off the rails crazy, was actually what inspired me to run for office. And this district where I'm sitting in right now, House District 135, had been represented by a Republican, for the same guy, for 24 years. And he had beat the last opponent by 10 points in 2016. But in 2018, I came back and beat him by 2. So that was a 12-point swing in what was considered a ruby red district in Northwest Harris County. So all I got to say is, it's going to be on, baby. Like, Democrats rising up, people are up and down the ballot, motivated and activated, and there is a possibility that Democrats are going to win some races they're not expected to win, like I did in 2018.
Mm-hmm. And do you see... do I want to call it a policy change in the Democratic Party? Do you see the rise of progressives in the party? As we're watching the mayoral race in New York, which is fascinating. It is really the most fascinating race I think I've ever watched. And I'm not even in New York. So seeing more progressive, we've seen pushback from some Democrats in New York about progressives, and now we've got a progressive on the ballot who could possibly win.
As I think he's going to win.
He's probably going to win. So how are the Democrats handling the idea of more progressives coming into the party?
So I actually have a pretty salty take on this. Like, mm-hmm. I'm a progressive Democrat, and people thought I had to be a centrist. And while, you know, I like to think I'm pragmatic, I'm a progressive, especially on social policy, social justice, equity justice, that sort of thing. Here's the way I see it. These sort of, I don't know, corporate centrist Dems, sort of the old school Democrats that have been in office a long time, that are all scared and think a progressive can't win or whatever. It's like, yo, you need to read the room. This guy is about to win the mayoral race in New York. And the big time, like, party power brokers that are flipping out over this because they're going to have someone they can't control, like, I think they need to get used to it. I think it's going to be progressives that are going to be a the heart of a major surge in Congress, probably in the Senate, in state house races across the country. That's what our base wants. And that's really, at this point, progressive policies are stuff like, let's make people safe, let's feed children, let's educate the population. Like, it's not exactly wingnut stuff. It's the things that everybody wants. And we're just fine. And pardon my partisanship, but we're just finding that Republicans have chosen to abandon their morals and their values. And all they do is serve a convicted felon in the White House. And that's not going to fly.
That I actually had a question. I had a question on my brain and I lost it. And I'm so sorry, John, for that.
We're just talking here.
But I wanted to find out, how are Democrats now going to reach out to the voters who kind of betrayed the party in 2024 by putting this man in office in the first place? We're talking, how do we reach young men? How do we reach the immigrant population? How do we reach
So women? The first thing I'm going to say is, I'm looking at you, Michigan Democrats, who could not vote for Kamala Harris. And how's that working out right now? Mm-hmm. So it needs to be, it really needs to be, campaigning itself needs to be reimagined and re-envisioned. So we have to reach voters where they consume information. And the traditional campaign models, while that will still have value, the regular advertisements and yard signs and definitely block walking, certainly knocking on doors is how I won. We also have to be in all of the information spaces. So the podcasts and the radio shows and going on TV and having our progressives step into the lion's den on Fox News and One America, whatever. Like, we have got to get our message out. Part of the problem that we had in the last cycle was, by the time the Democrats were knocking on doors, people had already made up their minds because of the information they're consuming, you know, online and on TV and on talk radio. And so we have got to compete in those spaces.
Because let's face it, podcasting was exactly how he won. And it was through podcasts that this, I don't like to say his name either, but for the sake of the show, this is how Trump actually won a lot of voters that were maybe sitting on the fence. He won a lot of young men, especially young men. He won a lot of young men. And now there's a lot of buyer's remorse, of course. So basically put, you're now going to have to reach out to those voters who now have buyer's remorse, who have now realized that their votes were, well, dumb. So,
well, when your grandma loses her health care, when you have trouble getting vaccines for your children to go to school, when school districts are closing campuses and underfunded and can't keep teachers around, you know, it doesn't matter whether if you live in the city or the suburbs or rural Texas, there's some stuff that we all care about that these people in Washington are just plain screwing up right now. And that has to be our message, not just that they're screwing up, but that we have real solid solutions, that we are coming with progressive policies that will serve the public, whether you live in, you know, in the middle of red rural whatever, or you live in the heart of Houston, Texas, or in the valley or in the panhandle, no matter where you are, this stuff reaches you. And I think people that have been unaffected before are now having it actually touch their lives. You know, all those people who used to say, I don't like to pay attention to politics. Like, I try to stay out of it. If you do not, you may not be involved in politics, but politics is involved with you. And so if you fail to exercise your vote, these people can do whatever they want and just basically rob our country, rob your tax dollars to give billionaires, you know, more money, tax breaks. Like, nobody thinks that's okay.
And do you, how do you, okay, I'm sorry. Let's talk about the midterms for a little bit.
Let's talk about that.
If the Democrats were to win both the House and the Senate, what's the first thing that you think Democrats need to do day one?
Day one is remove the filibuster in the Senate. And day two is pass a voting rights legislation that outlaws gerrymandering, political vote picking, whatever you want to call it, enshrine voting rights in our national law. And then if you ask me, you know, I'm a progressive. If you want to balance things out, statehood for Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, add a few justices to the Supreme Court, and let's take away that the partisan advantage that has been handed to conservatives with the Electoral College, where, you know, if you look at history, like North and South Dakota became two states so they could have four senators. Those two states put together have less population than the city I live in. And so they shouldn't have four senators when California only has two and Texas, you know, only has two. And so you could really change the balance of power. And then you have to balance the Supreme Court with justices who are actually serious about the law and not creating partisan policy from the bench of the Supreme Court. And then if you want to go for really good measure, I would do term limits on all of us, including the Supreme Court. And then maybe we can get back to some good governance that's of the people, by the people, for the people.
What about finally getting the vote on the Equal Rights Amendment? Because why have we not?
As a kid when that thing was first being talked about in Congress. So, yeah, federal equal rights amendment that establishes all humans have rights, whether you're, no matter what the color of your skin or your ethnic background, or if you're LGBT, or if you're, you know, Native American or whatever. You know, right now, if they pass these maps in Texas, a black person's vote will count one fifth what a white person's vote counts. A Hispanic person's vote will count one third what a white person's vote was. So if you look at the racist crap that was built into the Constitution, the three fifths thing, they are literally trying to do that again by gerrymandering these districts. So we got to get some equity happening and equal rights amendment. I've said this over and over. Human rights are human rights. Trans rights are human rights. People everywhere should have the right to live free, live their lives fully expressed in any way, pursue happiness in any way they choose. As long as you're not messing with someone else, you should be able to do what you do. You know what I mean?
That's a fantastic answer, John. Thank you for that. Because I'm curious, why have we not? But we have enough states. Why have we not put the ERA through? We've had years to do this, and I don't know why the Democratic Party.
We've had freaking decades. Yeah. Like, it boggles my imagination how this isn't like what is it going to take in this country to decide every human living here has human rights? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, don't all humans deserve human rights? I'm just saying.
What do you think is the future of Texas, as far as you're concerned, with voting and everything else?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, people continue to flow into this state. More people move to Texas than any other state in the union. We have quite a bit of influx from California and New York. In between 2010 and 2020, state's population grew by 4 million people. And that was half Hispanic. And the next biggest chunk was African American. And then more AAPI moved in to Texas than white people. So in the last 5 years, since 2020, that trend has stayed exactly the same. 96% of our population growth is black and brown. So black, Hispanic, Asian, AAPI, and other. So while not all, no population is monolithic, and you can't say just because someone is this color or that background or came from this state or that state, that does not determine their partisan affiliation. But I think if you employ policy that serves the people, then you will win at the ballot box. And this state is doing super racist stuff right now with alien land laws, where they just enacted Senate Bill 17 in this session that does not allow people from China to buy land in this state. I mean, it, like, we're going back to like World War One, Civil War stuff that just people don't like it. They think it's unfair. And the truth is, conservatives, like conscientious conservatives, you remember back in the day, we used to be able to have reasonable discussions with people we disagreed with and our Republican friends. We could debate the finer points of policy and how you should do this or that. You know, we need to get back to that.
Until we have a new system in place. I know.
Dang it.
As a voter, I so miss those days. I miss the days when voting was boring.
When the news was boring.
I know. It's the honest statement to say, but I miss the days when voting was boring. You went to the, I voted straight Democrat, was home and was 15 minutes in, 15 minutes out. That's all I'm, as a voter, that's all I'm supposed to do. Now I'm being drawn into things that I'm like, now I have to have opinions about things. Now I have to think about how I want to approach people. Now I have to think about who my friends are. I've lost quite a few friendships due to the 2024 election. I've had to cut family members off due to the 2024 election. So I miss those days. I completely do. Will we ever see those days again? They may take about a couple of generations before that happens.
It may or it may not. So the way that things break, once something starts to, a movement gains momentum, stuff happens very quickly. And of course, we're seeing that right now with this authoritarian shift. But I think once people get fed up enough, there will be a breaking point. And I think this whole Epstein file controversy, that sort of thing is the sort of thing that might feed this. And while I think it's not super substantive, you know, like I didn't care if Bill Clinton got, you know, in the Oval Office. I actually don't care if some of these leaders were on an Epstein jet at one time or another. Now, if they're pedophiles, that we should act on that accordingly. But what I'm saying is, remember at the end of the McCarthy era, people were afraid to speak out while that was going on and they would be accused of this or that. It sort of has a ring like history rhymes. And right now, anybody speaking out against, you know, Donald Trump is going to get primaried or whatever. At some point, you know, enough people will wake up and be like the famous line, you know, have you no decency, sir? When, because human beings, I think, are naturally decent. And it takes some learning. Someone has to teach you to hate people. And so at some point, I hope people will kind of return. I've never lost my faith in humanity, although it gets shaken sometimes. But you have to think people of good conscience at some point will go, hey, that's wrong. It's just wrong. This redistricting thing, it's just wrong. You're changing the rules in the middle of a game because you know you're going to lose. Like, no one would put up with that in a football game or a basketball game. Like, oh, my team's going to lose, so we're going to change out all the refs. And now my team, every shot they take will be worth 4 points. And the other team, every shot they take will be worth 1 point. Nobody thinks that's okay. No one wants to see that.
And, you know, we're just about out of time. What do you want to say to voters about everything that has happened up until today in the last 2 weeks? What do you want to say to voters?
Right. I want to say, if you haven't paid attention before, the time is now. Pay attention, be involved, find out who represents you. You can Google in Texas, you can Google who represents me, brings up a form and put in your address. You get all the contact information for everybody that represents you. Engage with those people, check them out, learn what they're about, and then call their offices. Like, we keep records of that stuff. The people must let their elected employees know what they want. We're employees, we're temporaries in these roles. So politicians need to learn to respect their voters, and the way they do that is by having you engaged. So please get engaged and make sure no one stays silent.
Two more questions and then we're gonna call it a day, Chad. Any thoughts of maybe a major run later on in your future, maybe for a national office or something like that? I've jokingly called you senator several times, so I've often...
Well, I'm not running for Senate. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, you can't help but think about certain things. We're in the middle of all this, I'm kind of putting off all of that sort of thought and conversation, you know, where I'm not going to run for Senate or for Congress. So right now, my intent is to run to keep the HD 135 seat in Democrat hands.
Of course.
And I'm also working on school board elections. So the down ballot races are super important. And if you didn't think it mattered who sits on your school board, if you live in Cy-Fair or Katy School District, it matters now. So I would just encourage everybody to be involved. And then if you end up seeing my name on a ballot, it's hard to imagine I would do that this time, but mm-hmm. weirder stuff happens all the time. So I would just stay tuned.
Well, being that you were, that you still are Grand Marshal ally of Houston Pride.
I'm so proud of that. It's just such an that whole thing has been such an amazing mm-hmm. deal. And I don't know if folks want to go look at some of my speeches on the House floor. There's a reason why folks felt like nominating me for that honor. And then once being named, I have continued to speak out, to be vocal, to go after those people that go after any communities, but especially like these folks like to use trans people as political fodder. It's like, yo, these are human beings just trying to live their lives. Leave them the f*** alone. Mm-hmm.
And I think we've asked all the questions we can ask. And you know what, John? I'm so grateful that you sat down with me and talked to the Queer Voices community to let them know exactly what they need to know and how they need to get involved. Any social media you want to push, anything that, you know, that voters can maybe reach you and that kind of stuff. Send
all that information. Here's a quick little secret. If you Google John Rosenthal cell phone, mm-hmm. my cell phone number comes up because I used it when I first ran for office. Mm-hmm. Like one person working on the campaign and you have to write a campaign contact. It was me. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. But you can also find me on like the website, formerly known as Twitter. I'm John_Rosenthal TX. Or Facebook or Instagram. And actually, if you message me, I'll usually answer you. Mm-hmm. It may not be immediately, but I like to be easy to find. Folks should be able to find their elected employees and tell us what you want from us. So, please find me on social media, reach out. John Rosenthal TX is the website. Like, you can find me that way. We're in the middle of an upgrade on that thing. Hopefully it'll come out nice. But find me.
Well, you know what? Thank you, John, for being on our show. And ladies and gentlemen, you were just listening to John Rosenthal, representative of District 135. Thank you, John, for being on the show. And we are going to catch up with you next time because we need more updates. We need to know what's going on. So I'm hoping.
Hit me up in a week or two. We'll probably have some stuff going on.
Got it. So thank you, John, and we will see you next time.
Before we get to our conversation between contributor Brett Cullum and founder of Houston Broadway Theater and star of the upcoming American Psycho musical, all of our episodes need to be exactly 58 minutes long. And currently, we're at 56 minutes and 10 seconds. So here to fill 1 minute and 50 seconds of content, I'm here to talk about next week's episode. As you may know, Houston, where many of our team live and operate, has a lot of LGBTQ plus serving organizations and a lot of coalitions. We have the Harris County LGBTQ plus Commission. We have Queens of Houston, or Queer Unified Emergency and Empowerment Network. And we have the Mayor's LGBTQ plus Advisory Board, the latter of which has gotten a lot of media attention due to the abrupt firing of their chair under the former mayor. Next week, our episode will be dedicated to the former and new chair of that advisory board, so be sure to tune in next week. But let's get to our final interview of the episode with Tice Green, founder of Houston Broadway Theater and star of the upcoming American Psycho musical. Brett Cullum, take it away.
Tice Green is the founder and artistic director of Houston Broadway Theater. He started his acting career here in Houston with several companies, including Tuts and Stages, and then he ran off to New York City, and when there, he became a model. He became an actor. He became a singer. He has tons of hits with his rock and roll style cabaret performances, even made an album with legendary producer and writer Jim Steinman, who wrote for Meatloaf, Bonnie Tyler, and someone named Celine Dion. I'm not so sure if you know her, and Barbara Streisand. Tice has appeared on Project Runway as one of the male models for several seasons. And one of his biggest, latest gigs was an Andrew Lloyd Webber touring production of Jesus Christ Superstar. And Tice starred in last season's Next to Normal, which was Houston Broadway Theater's auspicious debut. And it was one of the best shows of the last year by a long shot, even when you compare it to other companies. Well, now he's back, and so is Houston Broadway Theater, with American Psycho, the musical, running at the Hobby Center September 2nd through the 14th. So nice to see you again, Tice.
Hello, hello.
All right, let's just, my first question, and this is the elephant in the room. American Psycho, are you insane? Because this is a cult musical, and you are bringing its regional debut to Houston. London and New York were shocked by this. It had a really hard time finding audiences. How are you going to get away with murder and show tunes in Houston?
Great question. Pass. No, I'm just kidding. Well, as a new theater company, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to bring titles to Houston that have not been here, or it's been a really long time since they've been here, or they've never been here in the capacity that we're bringing them. How do we find those audiences? I think that the reason that we exist is because those audiences exist and they don't have a place to go. They don't have a place currently where can you go and see what theater company here is going to produce American Psycho and do it at the Hobby Center. My big vision in creating this theater company was, you know, we have so many amazing small theater companies here that do 99 seat theater and black box theater, and that programming is really well handled with existing companies. And then we have behemoth companies, you know, like the Alley and Tuts. These are just like giant organizations where you go into these, you know, 2,000-3,000 seat theaters. I think that there's something where, you know, if you do really interesting titles on a really big scale, we're working to try to find those audiences. I picked American Psycho this year because, for a couple of reasons. One is not only has it never had a Houston debut, our production is the first union regional production. It has been produced a couple of times at what are called non-equity theaters, which just means that the actors are non-union and there's, you know, they're usually kind of smaller scale stuff. Ours is going to be the biggest production that the show has ever had regionally. We're also very lucky in that Duncan Sheik, who wrote the music, is working on it with us. He is lending his hand to give us insight. So that's exciting, especially for a regional theater. American Psycho is very interesting in 2025, because if you strip away the horror of it all and the Patrick Bateman of it all, it's ultimately a story about identity. Patrick is ultimately this guy who is trying to find his footing. The whole show is really about like the bastardization of the American dream, set in the late 80s, glamour and money and who's got the best clothes and goes to the best restaurants. And it's an interesting commentary to see in 2025, because we're seeing a really big gap, a big disparity between the classes, depending upon what side of the political spectrum you are, I think the story impacts you in a different way. If you're coming to the story of a more conservative viewed person, I think it's going to impact you in one way. If you're coming to the theater as a more liberal and left-leaning person, it's going to impact you in a very different way. Houston is a city that is quite diverse in both culture and political leaning. Our audiences, I think, are going to be filled with people that have a mixture of views and cultural backgrounds. So that's going to be very interesting to see what their response is.
Let me geek out a little bit here for a second. I absolutely was thrilled to see the announcement that it was American Psycho. And I was like, you are kidding me. This is amazing. I love Bret Easton Ellis. I have read every one of his books. I read the book when it came out in 1991. Bret admitted a little bit later that it was a very personal book for him, that he felt like it was something that he slipped into Patrick Bateman's world, where he lived in this kind of consumerist void that was supposed to give him confidence, but really made him feel just completely isolated and not there. If you flash forward about 10 years, in 2000, Mary Harron directed a movie of it, and the book was considered unfilmable because of the graphic violence and all of the things that have happened in the book. And Mary really introduced a satirical element into it, just like in Bret's books, that maybe it's not as real as we think it is. And maybe it's not as real as Patrick thinks it is. So the musical, Duncan Sheik, Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa, is that what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right. He's famous for comic book writing as well as plays. Duncan Sheik obviously making it more of a rock thing, which makes sense for you and your company, by the way. I've never seen the musical. I've heard it, but I've never had a chance to. And I think that's one of the things that's really exciting, is that Houston is actually going to have a chance to see this when it has been very limited produced. I mean, I was looking through the productions, and the significant ones that I can find are like 2013 in London, 2016 in Broadway, 2019 Sydney, 2023 in Chicago. It went all kinds of awards that year. And there is a 2026 London revival, which is set to go up as well. So it's a great time to do it. So don't think I'm totally excited about it. But I think it's a tough sell in a weird way, because there was so much controversy around every iteration of this piece of work. It is kind of interesting to see it as a commentary on delusion, maybe. Tell me a little bit about your cast.
It's a half Houston cast and a half Broadway cast. So that's always been built into our mission, is to have not necessarily half exactly every single time, but the mission from both backstage to onstage is to mix Houston professionals with Broadway professionals. There's a couple of people in the cast that are coming to us like directly from having graduated at Sam Houston. This is their first professional regional show. So that's pretty cool too. I think the makeup of all the different kinds of people. We also have people in the show that have Broadway credits that are from Houston originally, that live in New York now, but now they're coming back home in order to be in the show. That's how I grew up doing theater. I was always in shows and casts that did that. The way that I learned how to be a professional was, it was less about getting proper training in a classroom, and it was more about just being thrust into a show. And then I was 19 doing The Sound of Music. I was playing Rolf, and the Captain Von Trapp was the longest running beast on Broadway. I just thought that was the coolest thing. And then Maria was like the only woman in the history of Les Mis to have ever played both Fantine and Cosette. Like, she started as Cosette and then she graduated to Fantine, and you know, between the two of them, they had like 15 Broadway credits.
It's a tough show to cast, I think, because you've got a lot of men in their mid-20s. And it's a very specific look. It's a very specific act. Duncan Sheik has written a very specific score that sounds late 80s, early 90s kind of pop rock. It's tough to execute. So, I mean, was that hard to find the people that could actually approach this? Because this is not your average musical.
The score is very interesting. You're right. There are some 80s tunes that are infused into it. What is unique about the handful of 80s tunes that are infused in it is that they are all completely rearranged. You know, usually in jukebox musicals, and this isn't a jukebox musical, but usually when you have existing songs, pop songs that are infused in a musical, they're kind of musical theater-ified, but they're pretty much like the originals. Like, you know, because the whole point is to have something in the show that people recognize and they, you know, is mimicked on stage. With this show, it's very different. Like, you know, there's like a choral arrangement of In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins, which is very different than the original. So I think the way that it's infused in the show is very interesting. And then, yeah, his music, you know, I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but I would go so far as to say the show is definitely set in like 1989. The music feels way more 90s. It's like, it's a little bit more electronic and has more of like a clubby kind of sound to it. But I don't think that's anything that Duncan wouldn't say. So you're right. We do.
In his defense, yeah. Tice, I was there. And I can tell you that the sound of the show, from what I've heard, is pretty true to 1989.
Okay.
It's definitely, okay. It does have that vibe. Because you have to remember that when we were crossing decades, usually the decade starts right in the tail end of it. And then the 90s kind of started in 89. They were kind of moving towards that. So this is a very show that is steeped in the late 80s, early 90s. And I heard that very prominently in the soundtrack. Absolutely. But I do agree with you. It was what became popular in the 90s. But it was definitely something that was bubbling up through the clubs at that point. But one of the things that's interesting to me about Duncan is, like you said, he's taken songs that aren't necessarily club songs, like In the Air Tonight, and made them kind of commentaries in the show and things like that. And that's definitely not one that sounds slick, and because it is kind of a choral arrangement of it.
Absolutely. You know, you asked about, like, was it difficult to cast? And so weirdly, I wouldn't say that it was difficult to cast. And I'll tell you why. Because the show has not been done very often. I mean, you can count it. Like you said, there has been a production in Chicago, at least in the US, and a production in after Broadway. A production in Chicago and a production in DC. They were both small black box productions that got a lot of acclaim, but that's it. And we had a lot of turnout for the show. And it was really cool seeing in the auditions. We did auditions both in Houston and in New York. And I mean, there were some people that walked into the New York auditions where I went, really? You want to do it? Like, you want to do our show? Okay. You want to come down to Houston? Person who I've seen do, you know, 3-4 Broadway shows. You know, to speak to your point about the film director and about, you know, the difference between the novel and the film, the musical also its own version. What we're finding is that there's a pretty stark difference between what the script calls for and what the original Broadway direction was like. Rupert Gould was the Broadway director, and he's also directing it again at the Alameda in London coming up for the revival. He started it more grounded, and it sort of got way more surreal as the show progressed. And then by the end of it, in the second act, like, you've got Patrick, like, in his underwear, almost Sunset Boulevard style now, you would call it, drenched in blood, doing, like, scenes where the other people in the scene don't acknowledge that he looks like that, and they just do sort of a regular scene. So that was very, like, surreal. The movie is satirical in a way that it's coming from a real place, but then there's just these, like, kind of wacky, I would go so far as to say, like, a little cartoony sometimes. Like, there is definitely, like, a thread of heightenedness that is in the movie that comes with this kind of tongue-in-cheek, wink-wink kind of thing. And it's also very 80s, the movie. The fashion is very 80s. They were not afraid to do, like, a boxy suit, teased hair, like, you know, so they went really full on that. The musical kind of, like, the music, dipped a little bit more into the 90s with a little bit more kind of slimmer silhouettes. And I think it kind of suspended disbelief there on the fashion. I'll tell you, like, our production, we really are trying to start it and keep it as grounded as possible. And I think the reason for that is, like, the director, Joe Colarco, no matter what the subject matter is, he's always looking to strengthen the relationships between the characters. Relationships are everything on stage, regardless of what the cadence is or the tone. Everything is just about people interacting with each other and what those relationships are about and what they want from each other and what the conflicts are. It's way less graphic than the novel. The show accomplishes paring down some of the really, really crazy vulgarity of the novel, but retains some of the retains the groundedness. We're not playing super high satire. I think that the musical elements in the show lend themselves to the satire. It's a musical, right? So a musical already has a little bit of, like, we're singing, so you can't take us too seriously. Anyway, I'm excited about it because I think there's an opportunity to let the satire come through, but really come through from a grounded place. And I'm interested to see how people respond to that, because I think when it's played really real and really straightforward, and the jokes are just funny because they're being played in a very real way, then you start asking those questions, like you said. One of the coolest parts of this whole story, whether it's the novel or the movie or the musical, is there are moments in the show and in the story where you go, is that really happening or is that in his mind? And I think when you play it from a grounded place, it makes it harder for the audience to know that, and it allows for a lot more interpretations. I think it's cool. That's one of my favorite parts about the whole story.
You know, I want to ask you a little bit about the tech. You mentioned Next to Normal, and the tech for Next to Normal was amazing. It was really great. But you guys ran one weekend. And then with this one, you've got September 2nd through the 14th. So you grounded a little bit longer run. Is this set? I mean, and again, a challenging set. I mean, there's a ton of locations here, Tice.
Yeah.
You have to go to Les Mis at intermission. I mean, come on.
You sound like my production manager, okay? Stop yelling at me.
The sets are going to be wild. How are you going to solve that part of it?
Yeah, well, and, you know, we have a set design that's done, and we're in pre-production now. And, you know, we've been able to... Zilka's a small space, and so without giving too much away, we've been able to kind of, not dissimilar to Next to Normal, like kind of create a playground where things can come on and off, and small pieces and props can come on to kind of create, you know, this new setting, and then go off, and then we go over here to this side, and we're in this new setting. We're playing around with more projections. There's some interesting TV elements involved, and
it has to be, because Patrick Bateman is obsessed with television. So
yeah,
you have to have that in there. And then the gore, that's a whole world unto itself as well.
This was the first time I've ever been in a production meeting where the word blood cannon was used. And, you know, one of us asked, we were like, what exactly is a blood cannon? That's interesting. That's one of the things we've had to sort out, is like, because that's special effects, and figuring out how we're going to do that. And I don't want to give it away, but what I will tell you is that the conversations that were had were like, okay, do we, in this world of digital screens and stuff, do we animate the blood? Do we, you know, do we utilize a Sunset Boulevard style thing where you've got like one thing happening up here on a screen, but then, you know, then suddenly you see the blood in real life. That scene, especially the scene where, spoiler alert, where he kills Paul Allen. If you haven't seen the movie or read the novel, then, well, it's not really, you know, come on, where have you been? It's like not knowing the ending of Titanic, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, spoiler alert for a book that was published in 1991. Okay.
exactly. Yeah, it's an important scene. You know, he takes that axe, and it's the most famous scene in the movie. And so we're really taking it seriously and trying to play around with what's possible in a small space. But again, this is another reason why I pick shows like this, because there's all these different elements of theater that are challenging for a reason. But here we are having the opportunity to put this stuff in front of Houston audiences. Most people, I mean, we're finding this, like most people, nobody knows that there's a musical, you know, unless you're like a niche theater person in New York, or you know, or you just know it from being a theater person. Nobody knows that there's a musical. But what's been really cool is, like, just in our current marketing efforts, like the people that have responded to it by going, oh, I love the movie, and whoa, wait, it's a musical.
I mean, come on. Okay, so the London production, Matt Smith and Jonathan Bailey were in it, which is amazing. Yeah. The Broadway production, Benjamin Walker helped workshop it and then carried it on there. I mean, it definitely has a pedigree to a degree. I mean, it's definitely one of those, but it is kind of one of those that did not have a long run, is not going to be well known, did not tour around the country. I mean, Tuts is not going to be doing this part of season whatever they're on right now. So yeah, I mean, it's a bold move, and it's definitely the show that I'm looking the most forward to this year. I'm very excited that you're doing it. I think bringing it with Houston Broadway Theater and doing it half Houston and half Broadway, brilliant stroke. Bringing in all of these people, I mean, I'm totally stoked for it. I mean, I don't want you to get the impression that I'm not, but I do think it's a little bit, what is the word?
Well, you think it's risky, I'm sure.
It is definitely a risk. It is definitely one of those things that you look at theater, and theater is about creating solutions to problems. And I think that American Psycho has some really interesting problems to solve. So my hats are off to you for taking that on, because this is definitely not the simplest musical that I've heard being produced this year.
Well, I'll tell you this, because like from an audience perspective, look, because sometimes when I think about programming, I try to simplify a lot of the times. Like I just try to go, like, if I'm just a muggle, so to speak, right? And I'm going out for a night at the theater. Well, there's a lot of different reasons why I can go and see a show. There's a lot of different places that I can go and see a show, or go to a concert instead, or go, like, I have a lot of choices, right? The going out for an evening, you have a lot of choices. And so we're trying to be a unique choice. I have so much respect for the amount of theater that we have in Houston. Like, I think the fact that we even have the capability to be a new theater company that has the prospect of inviting in new audiences is because there are already audience bases that exist that have been exposed to theater, at least in some capacity, whether it is, like I said, all those other places that I mentioned before. And you're right, like Tuts is not going to do American Psycho. But that's also not what Tuts does. How amazing is it and how like culturally significant is it to be like, you've got Spelling Bee going on in Tuts and then next door you have like, you know, someone swinging an axe and blood firing. Tuts is where I grew up. We keep talking about Tuts, but that's where I grew up doing theater. And I love all the shows there. And I love the entire team there and professional. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
I was gonna say, they're a legendary company here. I mean, obviously been around forever and done some of the most ambitious things here and you know, originated some shows here and definitely specialized like the Disney type musicals. I mean, Beauty and the Beast started here with them. They've mm-hmm. done a lot of things like that. And FYI, Heathers was at Zilka Hall and Tuts actually right. helped produce right. that. So there you go. And not to denigrate them, but it definitely is an ambitious choice. I think this is what I'm trying to say is that it definitely is a risky. It's an edgy one. It's one that I really, really respect. It says a lot to your integrity as an artist and a lot to your ambition as somebody, as a producer, to actually take this project on. And I'm very excited about it. I mean, it's definitely one of the shows that I am absolutely looking forward to the most in 2025. So.
It's going to be cool. It's really going to be cool.
Just to remind everybody, American Psycho, the actual musical, and yes, there is a musical, and it will run at the Hobby Center September 2nd through the 14th, presented by Houston Broadway Theater. Your director again, real quick, who?
Joe Calarco.
And then, of course, you've got an entire amazing technical team taking this on and everything else, a bunch of cast members that we can't even mention yet, but I'm sure as we get closer to the date, I'm going to pull you aside to do that. But in the meantime, break legs, sever limbs, a couple of axes to some actors, whatever. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Queer Voices, heard on KPFT Houston and as a podcast available from several podcasting sources. Check our webpage, queervoices.org, for more information. Queer Voices executive producer is Brian Levinka. Deborah Moncrief Bell is co-producer. Brett Cullum, Davis Mendoza Druzman,
Eva Michelle Gans,
Mel Peterson,
and
Joel Tatum
are contributors. The News Wrap segment is part of another podcast called This Way Out, which is produced in Los Angeles.
Some of the material in this program has been edited to improve clarity and runtime. This program does not endorse any political views or animal species. Views, opinions, and endorsements are those of the participants and the organizations they represent. In case of death, please discontinue use and discard remaining products.
For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
States Air Force, and I deployed 3 times. Being a veteran, it's interwoven into your DNA, is really the absence of the connection and the purpose that can really drive a lot of veterans to some negative thoughts. For those who are in a suicidal crisis, the window of time to save somebody's life is very short. Our duty is to protect ourselves and protect our families, and one way you can do that is store your weapons safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. About 2/3 of Americans say they worry about global warming and support policies to reduce it, but most do not realize that their views are so widely shared.
What we found is that the vast majority of Americans underestimate just how many of their fellow Americans support these transformative climate policies like a carbon tax or a Green New Deal or a 100% renewable energy mandate.
Greg Sparkman is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at Boston College. His team asked more than 6,000 Americans to estimate the percentage of other Americans who worry about climate change and support climate policies. They compared those numbers with polling data from Yale and George Mason University.
While actual supporters of climate policies outnumber opponents 2-1, we see that Americans think it's the other way around.
This misperception matters. When people feel alone in their views, they are less likely to take action. So he says it's important to start conversations about climate change.
To voice your concerns about climate change to others, to talk about climate policies you think are exciting. These kind of conversations, when done en masse, will help correct this misperception.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Hi, I'm Dan Spencer, KPFT listener, supporter, and volunteer for over 30 years. KPFT's mission is to provide community access to the airwaves. I support storytelling on the air, done by listener volunteers. Short stories, poetry, and books to engage and entertain. We need a break from the hard, real world to let our minds be soothed with other thoughts.